Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host today. This week, we have a special show where it's a panelist-only show. It is a year-end wrap-up for 2020. I know most of you don't really want to remember 2020, and we look at it and we have 2020 vision of what we don't want the year to look like this year. But I think it's important to reflect on what happened and why and where we are today and to look at this year with a fresh lens. Let me introduce the panelists. This week, we have our very own Barbara Friedberg. Hey, Barb.
Hey, Kirk. Happy to be here. Happy 2020 is over.
I think we would all agree with that. And we also have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hi. Hi, Kirk. Hi, Barb. It's good to be in 2022. But I got to say, as rough as 2020 was for investors, it was actually a pretty decent year. So looking forward to talking about this.
Yeah, and I think that's a great intro to the topic that we're going to talk about here. As we get into this topic, there's a lot of different lenses you can look at 2020 through. And I think we want to touch on all of them this week because they're all really important to consider. You know, the end of the year numbers is, well, that's what everybody looks at as the indicator of how they did. I think there's a lot more detail that needs to be kind of brought out here so people really understand what happened throughout the year. Megan, let's start with you. How did your year go personally? I know we can't talk about clients. Yeah. So like personally, like your investments, like how did that go for you?
Yeah. So 2020 was an interesting year. And it actually, for my portfolio, ended in a positive year. Like a lot of investors, I was apprehensive coming out of the end of 2019. Because if everybody remembers, the market had been up significantly in 2019. So I was apprehensive and I wanted to make sure my portfolio was poised for a good 2020. So what I did at the end of 2019, and I did this across client portfolios as well, is I trimmed positions and moved back to target. So my overarching target is 60% equities, 40% fixed income. And I wanted to make sure I had the right amount in fixed income in particular. So I locked in some gains. As the year played out, when we got to February and we got to that volatility, and you know, I remember talking to clients because there was, I don't know if you guys remember the controversy about, you know, had they ordered the right COVID tests? And you know, the US had rejected the WHO's recommendation. And that's where we started to see market volatility. And so like in a lot of my client accounts, I started to get ready to accelerate my tranching plan. And what I mean by that is every year I have money going into the market on a monthly basis with the philosophy of if the markets pull back beyond a certain point, I will accelerate the next tranche. And so at the end of February, I started to accelerate tranches into the market, not just in my portfolio, but in client portfolios as well. And I want to make sure it's very clear. I don't invest in anything that my clients don't invest in, partly because I think it's really important philosophically for me to experience what my clients are experiencing. So we had a lot of acceleration of tranching, and that continued during the drop in the V-shaped part of what we experienced last year. And did a lot of investing in March and April. And as everybody recalls, over the course of the year, we kept having these moments and kept finding moments to invest in. So overall, my portfolio did well at the end of the year. And I'm sitting here today looking at the fact that I need to do some rebalancing. My portfolio in 2020, I just ran the numbers, and I want to explain why I run the numbers. But my portfolio return in 2020 was 11.04%. And I'm going to put a little asterisk on that because the one thing I don't have factored into my return is I had invested in some cannabis private equity that did phenomenally well last year. But anyone who's invested in private equity and venture knows you never really know your returns for a number of years. So why I focus on how I did on an annual basis is I do a lot of back testing of portfolios. We do this for clients because we don't know, you know, it's that old saying, we don't know where the markets are going to go, but we can tell you where they've been. So this portfolio tested over time has typically returned about 6.2%. So when you have an up year like this, I like to track performance consecutive year over year over year so that I can understand how my portfolio has done over a cumulative basis. So when I look back, you know, and I, for the performance system I'm on, I've been on it since 2015. Since 2015, my portfolio has returned 8.6%. So why this is so important is I don't just believe in just looking at performance. I think performance has to be tied to your planning. So when I run long-term cash flows for clients or for myself, I build into the cash flow a certain rate of return that is supposed to occur. And so in my long-term cash flow for a 60-40 portfolio, I've been running a 6.2% target. When I have portfolio returns that have exceeded that, what that starts to tell me with my model that I'm using as a baseline to get myself and my husband to retirement is we are ahead of where we need to be. And that's pretty powerful in looking at it in that context, because I know that the portfolio has exceeded the assumptions I've put into my modeling. Now, some people would tell you that maybe I'm not modeling correctly. Maybe I'm being too conservative. When I model for retirement planning, I model with the hope that things go for the best, but I'm planning for the worst. And so I model with high inflation and low return. And I'm trying to really see if my portfolio can stress test. So taking the 2020 performance or what the markets did in context of retirement planning, for a lot of people, I anticipate 2020 was a good year in moving you closer to your retirement goals. So I know I just said a lot there, Kirk. So I'm going to pause.
Dude, I'm stoked about your cannabis investments.
I will tell you, just as a side note, we have gotten back. So we've been invested in it for maybe 20 months. And we have gotten back in distributions almost 25% of what we invested. For anyone who invests in private equity and venture, most people know it's a 10-year investment and it's a standard J curve. So usually you don't start getting distributions until years 6, 7, 8. The fact that I've gotten a distribution in that this early, it tells you a lot about the cannabis industry.
No, that's great. And just make sure you don't get high on your own supply. That's all.
Exactly.
No, I think
in California, it's legal.
That's true. Yeah. No, I want to touch on a few things. I want to get to Barb too, is, you know, looking at the year end, you're talking about valuations, which I think is really important. Last year was a really interesting year in many regards. I think we kind of looked at the valuations going into 2020 the same way, where, you know, right around the beginning of Q4 of 19, things look like they were starting to take off, and then the valuations are already stretched and they just got more stretched. I think by February, it was kind of scratching our heads thinking, wow, can it go any higher? And of course it didn't. And to put it in perspective, I think last year, if you kind of look at it as a chart, it was really interesting to see, because, you know, going into the year, the valuations are already stretched and expensive. And I think they got to a point in February 19th of 2020 where the forward PE was like 19, you know, which is higher than average. That was for the S&P. But if you look at, you know, where it is as of the end of the year, it was like a 22. So if you consider the economics of what was going on, you know, businesses across the country were shut down, across the world, 100,000 plus businesses went out of business. And yet the market ended up higher for the year than it started. It's really kind of shocking to think about that, wow, the economy's so bad and yet the stocks keep going higher. And I want to touch on this in this show. I just wanted to point that out, that people really understand that if you're looking at your returns, you might think, hey, we did great last year, but it's not just where it ended up. Like, the ride really is what matters too, because while we did end up well, you don't really know where the end point is. And it's not just about the end point, it's about how you get there. Because if you're losing half your money at some point in the year to get up 10%, I would say that's not necessarily a win. I would say that's a risk that you need to be aware of. And I want to talk about that later here on the show as well. But I think last year was and we'll put some charts in the show notes, and we'll actually put a link to this great report that JP Morgan puts out once a year. It's like a book of charts. It's like 80 pages. And it's just full of graphics that kind of show, for all the data geeks out there like we are, you'll really appreciate this PDF. So we'll have access to that in the show notes. But Barb, how did you look at last year? How did you feel like you did?
There's a couple of things to think about. First of all, there's a big disconnect between the economy and the stock market. And we talked about this in prior shows, but the reality is that the stock market had a very, very good year, much better than one could expect given COVID, high unemployment, et cetera. And for stock market investors, like Megan said, it was a complete surprise. So where does that leave us now? The stock market, as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, which is a compilation of the 500 most important companies in the United States, and many of those are global companies, the return annually for last year was close to 17%. Compare that with the average over probably 100 years is close to 10% or 9%. So although investors can feel confident, happy that last year the S&P 500 returned quite a nice amount, it's also important to look at it in context. And we want to look at how we did last year. And I also have in the show notes a really nice video and article about how to actually figure out if your return was good or bad. Because a lot of people are going to say, wow, the stock market returned 17%. But like Megan said, my portfolio only returned 11%. I must be a horrible investor. No, that's not the right way to look at your investments. How you look at your returns and your investments is according to what you owned. Very few of us have 100% of all of our investment baskets in the S&P 500. And if we did, then we'd expect to have earned 17%. But most of us have some bonds or some REITs, real estate investment trusts, and other assets. And so clearly, you want to measure that portion of your portfolio against the benchmark or average return of those assets. So with Megan in a 40% fixed, 60% stock market portfolio, if an average fixed asset return last year, and this, I don't know, I'm just making a guesstimate, so don't send me any mean or nasty emails. You were wrong, Barbara. But probably bonds returned somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% last year, give or take, with appreciation and dividends. And if stocks earned 17% and you average that out, that puts you in the 9 or 10% range. So you have to look at how your specific portfolio performed in comparison with its related benchmark.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Barb. And I think we want to touch on that a little bit here with the benchmarks, because it's something that comes up a lot in conversations when we have new prospective clients coming in and talking, and they think, you know, hey, I got 20% last year. Why didn't I get 30? Because the market was up 30. And I think what people need to recognize is there are many different indicators that people look to measure performance. A lot of people look at the Dow, mostly because the news talks about the Dow. I don't know too many, if any, professionals in the financial industry that look at the Dow as the primary indication of how things are doing. It is an indicator, you know, but it's primarily large cap stocks and only a handful. The S&P tends to be a more broad-based indication that people use to measure the market. There are other ones too, but that is one that's most commonly used. So if you're thinking about how to measure your portfolio, think about what you're actually investing in comparison. So as Barb says, is having a comparative index. If you are 40% bonds, 60% stocks, then comparing yourself to the S&P 500, in up years, you're always going to be disappointed. In down years, you're going to feel good because you're going to have more bonds. But in up years, you're not going to feel as good because you're going to wonder, why am I underperforming? And I think what you should recognize is it's okay to underperform the S&P if you're not trying to perform the same as the S&P? If you are, then that's a different question. But you need to know what you're measuring your benchmark against. So like what Megan does, you know, I very much invest similar as my clients. I also do some other things which are a lot riskier, which I don't think would be easy to bring to my clients to probably get in trouble, but I'm okay with taking that risk. And I understand the risk I'm taking, and it's okay because I acknowledge, if you look at, let's say, like cryptocurrencies, there's acknowledgement they could go to zero. And if you invest in those, you have to acknowledge the fact that they could go to zero. They might not. It's not a question of whether you think they will or not. It's a question of possibilities. And if you recognize that you could lose all your money, then it's fine. You know, you're capable of investing there. And there are some other investments that are very similar in nature, where it's an all or nothing. You either hit a home run or you hit a zero. Like, you know, angel investing, or maybe not so much venture capital, but angel investing can be very similar in startups, where, you know, people invest in startups. A lot of those go to zero. Some of them hit home runs or grand slams, and that makes up for the ones that go to zero. I think you need to understand what you're measuring against, so you're not disappointed with the returns. You need to know what you're expecting. And we're talking a lot about performance here because that's what the vast majority of people measure themselves against. They just look at what's the number? What's the number this year? What did I do? And there's no context for how they got there. And I really want to hammer on this point because this past year was such a crazy year in many ways. And I think people really need to understand what they're buying into when they're investing. It's not just the performance. If you look at the performance, say, hey, I got 17% last year. You know, what was it in March? I think that is a question you have to ask yourself. At the low point of the year in March, what was your performance? Were you comfortable with that and taking the risk of losing, you know, 30 some odd percent, 30 to 32, 35, something like that in March was the most it was down for the year. Are you comfortable losing that in a short period of time? And if the answer is yes, then that's okay. If you're not comfortable with it, then getting 17% return is probably not the best approach because you're not able to sleep at night when the market does decline, which inevitably happens. It is part of a market cycle. There are ups and there are downs. None of us want to go through the downs, but it is inevitable that those happen. And if you don't have a way to manage risk, then you're really susceptible to kind of the emotional swings that are going to happen if you look at your portfolio during the down periods. And that's usually where people make mistakes. So Megan, let's get back to you and talk about risk management.
Yeah. So look, what I always focus on first is asset allocation. And I know it sounds boring and trite and investors might be rolling their eyes, but the truth is asset allocation is just another way of saying strategy. I think it's always good when people feel uncertain to go back to strategy, because strategy is what gets you through the tough times, not the good times, right? So for me right now, even personally, I'm slightly overweight to fixed income right now, just because of an investment I had made. But what I'm focused on is making sure my portfolio can withstand some of the risks that could potentially happen this year. So when I think of it constructively and look at what all of the top economists at the different firms are saying, there's a lot of risk out there that I think as a long-term investor, we can navigate rather smoothly. The first is, you know, we are sitting in a period of time of divided government. And so as we switch presidential administrations, what's going to be really key is understanding, will divided government continue? And if it continues, will it have an impact on the markets and the economy? And I say this because one of the things that investors always should remember, and we saw it last year in March, is that the US companies in particular have some of the best executive management teams out there who have learned to become resilient during this. Even if the government's divided and that might create some volatility, we can also look at the fact that a lot of companies on the US side, at least, will still navigate through. The other things I'm concerned about are what we're calling techlash. And Barb and Kirk, I don't know if you guys are hearing a lot about this, but there is starting to be this idea that there needs to be more regulation of the tech industry. It is likely that we will see something happen, particularly with the Democratic administration. Now, a lot of investors benefited from having a lot of those companies in their portfolio last year. So techlash might have an impact on return. The other three things that are front of mind for me are things like, will we face a recession? And most of the economists say that there's a low likelihood. But again, it's always sort of something you're thinking about, but it's not the biggest concern. And then the two other things are geopolitical issues. You know, we have continued to navigate as a country a very challenging geopolitical climate. But, you know, we need to see what the Biden administration is going to do with their China strategy. We also need to see what will happen with Russia and with North Korea and Iran. And there's a lot of hotspots around the world. And I think the other geopolitical thing to keep in mind is the U.S. is poised for a decent 2021, but is Europe? And with the UK exit, with, you know, getting their economies up and running again, we might see some sluggishness there. And then the last thing I would say is cybersecurity. I think the fact that there was a breach recently is disturbing. And I think that that could have an impact on portfolio returns.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And I want to follow up on some of them. I think as we look at the valuations, you mentioned techlash, it's a huge issue. It's been an issue for the last year. We'll leave the politics aside, but I think there's always been this issue of people feeling like, you know, the tech companies are in charge of your First Amendment rights, and they're private companies and legally they're allowed to do that. The question is what is the impact on society of not allowing people to, you may not agree with their opinions, but, you know, that's the point of the First Amendment. Just because you disagree doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to say them. I agree with your point. We don't know where it's going to go. There's definitely a lot of talk in the last few years about treating a lot of these tech companies kind of like utilities, because you can't have two Microsofts or two Google. Well, I guess you can't have two Googles, but you're not going to, in the nature of the technology and how it grows, you're not going to have two Amazons. It's just, it's possible, but everything tends to flow towards one place because the bigger get bigger. And in technology, this is what tends to happen. So the question is how do you deal with that? Because that's basically a monopoly. And monopolies from Econ 101 are not good. It doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that you don't have competition. You don't have natural pricing mechanisms. There are a lot of negatives to that element that's really important. So there should be more discussion around it. I don't know what that'll end up being. But I mean, the tech companies have been driving returns for a while. And if you look at like the S&P, for example, the top 10 stocks, which are inevitably almost all of them are tech stocks, but most of them anyway, you know, as of the end of the year, it was 28% of the S&P was in 10 stocks. So there's an index with 500 stocks close to, well, say 28% or almost 29% are in 10 of those stocks. That's really kind of accentuating one of the problems, which is the big get bigger, and they tend to have more influence on the index. So what inevitably will happen is you have things like the FANG stocks, for instance, which are, you know, all in the top 10, I believe. And if the top 10 tend to get bigger because more money goes into the top 10, which makes them, it's a positive reinforcement loop that causes them to keep growing. And it's maybe not necessarily a natural effect. It's mostly because the way the market operates and index funds and all the institutions, they operate in a certain way, which positively reinforces these companies. So if you looked at performance this year, a lot of that was tech related. It wasn't until the end of the year where the rest of the economy really caught up and some of these other companies actually caught up in performance. I think it's important to understand that it's not, well, last year was not broad-based. At the moment, it is. There's a lot of participation across different sectors, but most of the year was mostly led by tech. And people have been talking about this for a while, but that creates a real issue in how do you have a handful of companies dictate the performance of most of the index? And then the question is, which a lot of people have figured out, well, why not just put all your money in those companies because you're going to perform better? That obviously creates a risk problem down the road because you've got, let's say one of those companies hits a speed bump and then, you know, you've only got five stocks and now you're hitting a speed bump, if you will.
You know, Kirk, I want to just jump in real quick and say one thing about this, which is we've been here before. I think it's always good to look at history. And David Kostin, who's in charge of equity strategy over at Goldman, has done some research on this. because Americans are concerned about competition in this area. They're also concerned about the data that these companies hold. And when they went back and looked historically at last time we had, you know, sort of regulation put on high growth companies, you know, the three eras are back in the 60s, we have IBM. We have in the 90s, we had Microsoft. And in the 70s, we had AT&T, right? And so what they found in studying when regulation came in on all these industries is that growth slowed and valuations fell. And so I think the thing for investors out there who've built portfolios based on tech stocks, you know, this is where you should take as an inflection point, which is, okay, the market is going to change. The companies might not change as much as the outside environment is. And as the environment changes, am I positioned correctly going forward? And I, as a tax person, never be afraid to pay tax on something you made money on. That's a blessing. So don't be afraid to take something off the table in order to sort of shift your strategy.
Yeah, it's really important. And some of the other topics, I tend to agree. I think one of the areas that I found really interesting as I've been reading a lot of commentary at the end of the year from economists, like we were saying, Megan, there are a lot of people out there with predictions. And predictions is a love-hate thing. We all like predictions because we all want someone to predict the future for us. But I think you all have to recognize that nobody can predict the future. Sorry, I let the cat out of the bag, but we can't predict the future. So, you know, really what you can do is you can have an opinion, you can have a thesis of where things are going. I mean, every year at the end of the year, I hear the value drums beating. Oh, it's been 10 years. This is going to be value's year. You know, value is going to do great. And for 12 years, it's underperformed. And I think it's important to kind of think through like why things are going to happen the way they are. Now, I think there's a lot from what I've been reading, there's a lot of interesting commentary around based on how things are lining up that international might have a lot more interest this year, especially in emerging markets. We've certainly seen a little of that towards the end of last year, but it's an area that a lot of people are looking at, and the emerging markets tend to trend strongly, meaning the returns are stronger, but then the downside is also larger. So with risk comes reward. There are areas like that that I agree with Megan in terms of Europe being in stagnation. It's important to revisit certain areas that maybe people aren't looking at, but cybersecurity is a big one too. And I think the market is kind of showing that in some of these prices. One other area I want to point to, and I don't want to take all the good ideas from Barb. If you think about the Democratic power that's sweeping in, they tend to be focused on infrastructure. Now, we don't know if that's going to happen, but if you're spending a lot of government money, it's easy to spend money on infrastructure because A, we need it, and there's not enough spending on infrastructure. But certainly it's something that is, it would seem that might be a likely place where funds to go. So another area to kind of explore, and I think as Georgia election was decided with the runoff, we saw a big jump in some of those infrastructure companies. So Barb, what are your thoughts for this year?
Well, I think we've covered last year, and there's a pretty good consensus that overall the stock market was uneven and the returns of the S&P 500 were extremely robust last year. And so now as investors, we have to take stock and decide, well, what should we do now? I want to make a couple points real quick. If you have your asset allocation, as Megan was discussing, you want to make sure you adhere to it because you created that percentage in stocks. And within stocks, you have certain percentages that are probably allocated to US, to international. Maybe you go with some small cap or some value stocks. You want to make sure that you are adhering to that and rebalancing. So having the appropriate percentages in those areas. And the same with fixed assets, because your asset allocation has been proven to be responsible for close to 90% of your future returns. And I know that sounds crazy, but pretty much what that means is certain sectors rotate, certain types of stocks rotate. And although we can guesstimate which ones those will be in the future, we obviously do not know for sure. And that's the benefit of diversification. So you're never going to have the best return in the world, but you also won't have the worst. So for next year, you want to make sure that you are diversified. You also want to understand what are reasonable expectations for your returns. It is unreasonable to think that next year the S&P 500 will also return 17%. Although it is possible, research, and that's all we have, we don't know the future, research has shown that when the forward price earnings ratio, which is simply a measure of the valuation of the stock market, it takes a stock's current price and or projected price and divides it by their earnings, or does the same with a benchmark, the forward, and that is looking at the forward earnings for the S&P 500 at present is about 22.3%. Whereas the 25-year average is 16.6%. So clearly we're overvalued. That doesn't mean that we won't continue to be overvalued. But what research has shown is that when we are overvalued in the stock market, future returns over time tend to be lower. So I'll leave you with this. Temper your expectations for next year. Remain diversified. And also, if you're interested in playing some sectors that you think might outperform, such as Kurt discussed earlier, don't put all of your eggs in one basket, but allocate a small portion of your investments to those sector or more niche investment categories.
Yeah, and I actually want to chime in on one point that you made, Barb, with the PE ratio. Actually, if you look at the top 10 stocks, and the PE ratio is 33.3. And the average of the top 10 over, I think it was over like 20 years.
And that is such an important data point, because does that mean they're all going to go down this year? Absolutely not. One thing we know for sure is that stock prices, businesses, they move in cycles. They go up and then they go down. The problem is we don't know in advance when the peak is going to be. So you have an idea that over probably 5 or 10 years, we are pretty darn sure that if you have a 33% PE ratio, that stock is not going to continue going up, up, up. At some point, it's going to have a reversal of direction. We just don't know where. So you don't want to put all your money in stocks that are overvalued by historical measures.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Barb. I think it's really important to kind of keep in mind that, and I know this is hard because, you know, philosophically, it's kind of like a circular loop, but just because stocks are going up doesn't mean they'll always go up. On the other hand, just because they're up, it doesn't mean they can't come down. And I think the point is not to put you into a mental loop that'll cause you to go crazy. It's just to recognize that you can't predict the future. You can only plan for it. So, you know, we were prepared for March of this past year. We didn't know it was coming, but we were prepared for it. So I think the way that to think about risk management is a lot of people talk about diversification. That is one of the most common ways to manage risk. But I think what's really important is just to think through different scenarios of what you're going to do when. For an example, if you feel the market is overvalued, at some point there's going to be like a March of 2020. Right? Like you just, at some point that's going to happen because it has happened in the past and it will happen in the future. And in cases like that, you want to have a list. You want to have a list of stocks you want to own at cheap prices. And if they get cheap enough, then you can pick them up and benefit from that growth. Because in March, there were a lot of stocks that sold off well more than they should have. And that's a good opportunity to have that list. But if you're trying to create a list in the moment, you're not going to have as much luck, because your head is going to be a different place. You're going to be an emotional wreck because your portfolio is down a lot and you're going to be thinking more about selling than buying. And it's, we call it financial resilience, but it's really being psychologically prepared for challenging or hard times. And if you're prepared, then they're easier to deal with. When you're not prepared, then you tend to kind of lose your emotional marbles. So part of risk management is being mentally prepared. And I think that's an important thing to consider. But as we kind of look to, you know, the year ahead, Any kind of final thoughts, Megan, for things that people should be thinking about, or, you know, how can they start the year off on the right foot?
Yeah. So look, I think the theme of 2020 was stay invested and you will be rewarded. And that theme should carry into 2021. There are a lot of optimistic things to be looking forward to. And if you're a long-term investor like me, you know, you want to make sure that you're sticking to your asset allocation and that you have a tranching or dollar cost average plan to put money to work every month or every 3 months or a certain time period. And you should be looking ahead and assume that through the year, as the pandemic improves, we are going to see more potential in both the US markets and the overseas markets for growth. We've all become incredibly resilient over the past 12 months. And so that means as we burst through to the other side of this pandemic, there's potentially a lot of upside. And the thing is, no one knows where the market's going to go. So you always want to be buying. You always want to be focused on the long term. And you want to just stick to your knitting, stick to your strategy. That would be my takeaway. I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me at The Wealth Intersection or at Megan_E_Gorman on Twitter.
Thanks for coming on, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And I would actually point out, I think I actually know where the market's going to go this year. It's going to go up. Yep. It's going to go up and then it's going to go down, and not necessarily in that order.
Exactly. I love it.
It might even go sideways. You never know.
Oh, yeah. It does happen every once in a while.
Yeah. So Barb, what about you? What are your final thoughts for this topic?
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm going to take your advice, Kirk, and pretty much I'm good to go. But additionally, don't be afraid to hold cash. In many cases, it's a very wise thing to do when you don't see a good investment value. And that way, you will make sure to have a little bit of extra funds available to deploy when there is that market drop. I love Kirk's idea of having your list. The funny thing is, I was just creating my list before the show of funds that I wanted to own after a reversal, because he's not kidding. When markets fall, people freak out, even professionals. So stay invested, do your dollar cost averaging, like Megan said, but also don't be afraid to divert some of your investment dollars into cash and save that money for a time when markets are lower and you can pick up some bargains. So my name is Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance and Robo Advisor Pros.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. Yeah, and I would like to reiterate Barb's point about keeping cash. I think that's really important. Cash is most people's nemesis. They look at that and they say, you know, I don't want to keep cash because it's going to lose value in inflation, right? I'm going to lose value over time. If you look at it as a math problem, it doesn't really work that way. Because in reality, if you really plan it out, if you look at a guy like Jim Rogers, like he keeps a lot of cash and then his philosophy is like, I'm going to wait till there's a pile of money sitting in the corner and I'm going to go pick it up. What he means by that is I'm going to wait till there's a no-brainer investment and then I'm going to go invest heavily in that investment. But in order to do that, sometimes you have to sit on a pile of cash. And people feel really uncomfortable with cash because they feel like it's not earning enough, or, you know, like if I'm not in the market, I'm missing out. And I think it's really a false premise thinking that way, because there are times, for instance, I mean, if you look at this year, right, if you take just for an example, like peak to trough, you know, I think there was about a 34% drop. And then from the low, there was a 68% rise. Now, maybe a 17% net return. But if you went all in at the bottom, which of course almost nobody did, you would have made 68% return. That's quite phenomenal. So are you really worried about inflation eating away at your cash? You know, if you think about it in that lens, you have to look at cash in a different lens. And another way I describe it is if you look at cash this way, cash makes money when the market drops. And let me accentuate the point. In 2008 and 2009, the market dropped over 50%. I think it was 58%, but let's call it 50 to keep the numbers simple. So you start with $100. And if you were invested in the S&P, it would have been worth 50 at the end of that time period. So your money got cut in half. And what kind of returns do you need to get back to 100? Well, you don't need 50% returns. You need 100% returns. Taking it from a different lens, your cash just doubled in value. Now, if you don't believe me, try to buy stocks after they go down 50%. You can buy double the amount. So your cash just doubled in value in terms of purchasing power. So cash does have a very strong value in a portfolio. It doesn't mean you should be sitting around in cash with your portfolio. It just means that you should not take the perspective that cash is a bad thing. It has strategic value, especially when no one else has cash. Because if no one else has cash, you can buy things at a very good price. So I think it's just important to think about cash in a different way when you're considering your portfolio. It's okay to keep cash, keep an amount that you're comfortable with, you know, keep it for the rainy day, whether it's an emergency fund or what have you. I just want to impress upon that because that's how people make those kind of returns, is when they have that availability to invest when the market's at a low. The other last point I want to make before we wrap up here is, there are a lot of people out there, as you're hearing these predictions for the year, there are a lot of permabulls. Most people out there are permabulls. No matter what happens, they're bullish. The market's down 50%, buy, buy. You know, I heard this all through 2000 to 2002 when I started my career, when every day it was like, oh, you got to get out there and buy. It's at a discount. And I kept thinking to myself, well, yeah, and it's still going down, so maybe I'll just wait. But there are a lot of permabulls out there, and their lens is always that it's going to go up. And historically speaking, that's the case. The market goes up 70% of the time, and it goes down 30% of the time. So statistically, it's going to go up more than it's going to go down, at least in the US. So being a permabull, the odds are in their favor, but it doesn't help you navigate challenging times. So you need to have some perspective in terms of, where are they really coming from? Are they looking at it from the perspective of, this is a good idea? Or is it from the perspective of, the probability is it's going to go up if you buy at a low price? And that has merit. And I'm not discounting that. It has a lot of merit, but you need to understand what makes you comfortable. And the other part is the perma bears. The perma bears argument, they're perpetually bearish. The market is always going to go down. It's always overvalued. Intellectually, it's always the most interesting case that they make. From an intellectual perspective, it's always going to be the most appealing case because they're looking at a lot of the numbers and it makes sense. The logic makes sense, but that's not how markets work. They don't work on information and logic. They work on emotions. So if you're looking at the market, you have to understand, what is the emotion of the market? That is what is going to help you dictate better than what is the logic behind the market. So that's it for this week. I'm glad we had a chance to do this year-end wrap-up. I think it's a good start for next year. I hope you all have a great 2021. We'll be helping you out through the year with a lot of great interviews. We have a lot of great guests lined up. I'm really excited to bring them some portfolio managers of different asset classes, and I think you're really going to enjoy this. So thanks again for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our show notes, resources, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.